It is Saturday, February 26, 2010, 2011, 10 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. My name's Lyle Troxell. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be doing geek news with here in the house. We have Miles Elam. Before we start the show, we're going to do a little story right off the bat with Dr. Don. Don, thank you so much for staying.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know these little portable devices that kids play games on. I'm talking about gaming devices. The new Nintendo 3DS. So it's a DS, but it's the third generation, has come out, and it's got a 3D mode. And I'm assuming the way this is working is that it's got kind of a prism effect on the screen where half of its data goes one direction to one eye and half goes the other eye. And since it's a portable device, if you hold it a certain distance away, you'll get a 3D image because you've got two different images in the eyes. And what they say, their official announcement, Nintendo's official announcement, is that you're supposed to take a 15-minute break every 30 minutes of 3D play, which seems a little excessive. So you can basically last for 30 minutes before they recommend stopping. I'm just curious.
That'll happen among gamers.
Especially amongst kids, right? I mean, how dangerous is... I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of studies about eye strain in reading. How bad is a long-term effect of straining your eyes like this?
Well, if you're still growing, really bad, because you're probably going to induce differential growth of the eyeball that would be different than you would otherwise have. The old adage about if you read in bad light, you're more likely to be nearsighted.
Yeah, I've heard that. Is that true?
It actually is true for growing children.
Interesting.
Oddly enough. And it has to do with where the image is being focused on the fovea. If you're looking at a distance, there's less refractive power needed to focus on the retina and the fovea because the rays of light are coming in parallel. And so you don't need to bend them as much to get them to resolve on a single spot, right?
And the closer your eyes get, the more the
rays are diffusing outwards from a close object, so the more you have to grab them and bend them in.
When you say fovea, what's the fovea of the eye?
Fovea is the most sensitive part of the eye where you have the highest density of...
Where all the color receptors are, right?
Right, the macula and fovea, that's the part of the eye that has the most resolution, if you will, most pixels.
You're non-peripheral, if you will.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Right.
So what's interesting is when I was reading through this article, they actually talk about the rest time necessary for non-3D play, which means that potentially anything you're getting close that's an electronic screen, because these are, if turning off the 3D version of the screen, it's really just equivalent to your cell phone, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was still impressed. I'm trying to scan through the article to find out what that duration was. I was still impressed that it seems like, they urge a 10 to 15 minute break every hour of normal non-3D play. Do you think that playing for over an hour on any kind of portable device at that distance is bad for your eyes? Is that...
Define bad for your eyes. I mean,
right.
Let's do that. Let's define bad for your eyes. Eye strain in and of itself hurts. The muscles of the eye are what are hurting.
Right.
And you have two sets of muscles, the sort of horse reins that turn the eye right and left and up and down, the rectus muscles, and the ciliary muscle, which changes the diameter of the pupil. And one of the reasons that you get eye strain with this up-close thing is that in order to bend the light, because the rays are diverging, you actually have to open up the pupil and squeeze down on the lens. So you're really tensing a lot of muscles in your eye in order to resolve that image. And I can just imagine that 3D image, particularly a moving 3D image that's being generated in an artificial fashion, is, you know, really pushing the ability of those muscles to resolve. And I'm also wondering what it's going to do to particularly in neurologically developing individuals, like, say, people under the age of 8, 8 to 10 years old, are really probably going to be profoundly affected by this. They may even develop different neural connections in their brains because of using these devices.
I mean, I'm concerned when saying this, of course, because we don't have a lot of data about this kind of thing.
Because
it's hard to... You don't do tests on kids
like
this, right?
Well, sure we do. We're doing a colossal bunch of uncontrolled social experiments on our children, including, you know, soda and diet.
Right,
and
they're just not...
Lack of exercise.
Right.
And your geeky stuff is just one more part of this great... elaborate social experiment that we're doing. I think it's I think it's a really, really good idea not to let your children spend a lot of time playing with these 3D devices. Older people over 18, you can make your own decisions, and worst case scenario, you need refractive surgery or you need to wear glasses.
Miles,
so what is the difference, just for listeners, and I personally don't know, between, if you're exercising a lot, you get muscle strain like in your arms or legs. And if you continue to do it in a controlled fashion, you get bigger muscles. You get bigger biceps. Is that or is that not the case with eyes? With the eye muscles?
To a certain extent, I think it's probably true. Certainly with the ciliary muscle, that's true. So the muscle does get bigger. And in fact, there are a whole set of exercises you can try to do if you start getting farsighted in your mid-50s. You can do certain exercises which will actually build that muscle and get you back some close vision. And there are programs out there. There's actually a lot of software programs that you can buy that will take you through the exercises. And they sort of work. They're not dramatic, and they take enough time that people generally throw them out the window before they get results. But
get glasses instead.
Yeah, they do sort of work.
Well, the decline took a long time. Why shouldn't the cure take a long time?
That makes sense. But you see, we have to work for the cure.
So
the decline happens passively.
I guess my non-medical response to Miles's questions, correct me if I'm wrong here, Don, is that when you're doing your workout of your muscles, it's quite easy to damage your joints. And potentially, if you're really failing, you're going to mess up other tissues of your body if you're doing too much exercises. But because our muscles are so connected with pain receptors, it's rare for the individual to thrash their body with doing exercising. But I guess not really. Knees fail all the time, right? So I would assume that in the eye situation, from a genetic perspective, have we had that much experience with this high concentration, close work? And therefore, are we prepared to do that? And from a structural perspective of how our bodies exist, does that make sense?
I think I'm grokking your question here. So, first of all, you make the classic error that fine close-up work is something new that
hasn't occurred.
No,
yeah, I was thinking of sewing right off the bat.
Sewing those little. When we were in China, we went up in the hill tribes, and there's these little old ladies with magnifying glasses sewing these fabulous little quilt applique things. And
right.
It's a big deal. That's the handicraft industry up there. So people have been putting their eyes out doing, fine jewelry work back to the Sumerians. So what happens under that circumstance is that you adapt to close work.
Right.
And you have, over time, you will develop farsightedness, and you will need glasses or some kind of magnifying device.
I guess kind of what I'm saying is that if you look at humans in the current duration of lifespan, it's very common for technical improvements of the body around the eyes, right? I mean, sure, we use canes for our bodies, but there's a lot of eyeglass wear and contact lens wear as you get into your 50s and above.
Sure.
So right off the bat, it's one of our weaknesses as a long duration species. And so I guess we can go on with the rest of the tech show. But Don, thank you for kind of talking to me about that. I'm really curious about how this 3D, pseudo 3D environment stuff that we're doing to ourselves is affecting our development.
Yeah, I think for the children, it could actually do something. For adults who no longer have that level of neurologic plasticity, I think it's just an issue for eye strain.
So are you saying it could do something in the sense that it could allow us to have different attributes as adults? If I take my 6-year-olds and make them use 3D screens?
If you're a 6-year-old and you're looking at a 3D screen, say 4 or 5 hours a day, you will develop different kinds of neurological connections, and they could be better. We don't know that they're going to be worse.
Yeah.
They might be pre-adaptive for a world in which there are, holographic 3D things coming at you all the time. And, a la blanking on the movie Minority Report.
Sure.
And if that's the case, we're pre-adapting. It's co-evolution. We're definitely co-evolving.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be better if we made the technology so good that your body wasn't getting strained?
Well, that would be your department.
Yeah, that's what I prefer.
That and the fact that we are now resigned to be the curmudgeons that go, oh, give me that holographic crap. Just give me a
3D
straight piece of paper.
Well, I for one am
welcome to senescence.
I'm for one feel like keeping my kids away from those close screen, especially 3D technology, until they're in their preteens area seems like a good, safer bet than experimenting on my kids.
I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah. Thank you, Don, very much.
Bye-bye.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Miles, hi. I think that I better do a little bit of this. We'll be right back. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be doing geek news the entire show. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And we just had Dr. Don Motika, and Don has a wonderful show right before us every week on KUSP. For you podcast listeners, you're welcome to podcast Don as well. You just get to the same way, go to NPR and look up KUSP, and you will find her podcast as well. The theme song today is my pet star music, Michael Newman. Thank you so much. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor, share and share alike, which means you can do pretty much anything you want with our content as long as you give us some credit, and you also share your content. In the Creative Commons way. Miles, let's go ahead and do... Oh, well, Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie. Hi.
Hi. Yes, you already said hi.
I know, but I'm saying again and hi, and I got the script thing, and oh, it's pretty weak. What you got for our first news story, sir?
Well, it's a very curious thing. We talk about like how fast we can get our internet connections at home, you know, the pros and cons of DSL versus cable, and do I need a 6 megabit connection? Can I get a 15 megabit connection with cable? You know, things like that. Well, South Korea is working on, by the end of 2012, to connect every home in that country with an internet connection that runs at 1 gigabit. Per second.
That's faster than we can have in our homes right now, isn't it?
Right. Just to put that into perspective, because I don't want to do some really fancy math, let's just talk about the base level DSL of 1.5 megabit. That means that they're targeting close to 1,000 times as fast as that. And in fact, that metric of 1 gigabit is approximately 200 times faster than the good cable connection that we get here in the U.S. And just wanted to point out that people talk about, oh, well, there's a high population density in South Korea. Well, there's also a high population density in New York City, in San Francisco, in Miami, in many cities in the U.S., and yet no one in the U.S. is getting anywhere close to the speed as a private citizen.
Right. True. Except for at work, right?
I mean, at 1 gigabit? No, you're getting it in a local area network, but you're not getting a connection to the internet at 1 gigabit.
Well, at my office, I get 1 gigabit.
Okay.
Because yeah, I work
tax
at university.
Dollars at work.
Because I work at a university, we do have that kind of connection speeds. But what that's typically called is Internet 2 in some sense, because it's so much different than what we normally
right.
experience.
Right, and it's also, you know, gigabit speeds for tens of thousands of people.
Right, right. That's true. So, how are they going to achieve this? Is it a completely brand new technology, or are they just going to brute force it with fiber? I mean, do you know how they're going to do this?
No, I don't really have that,
but
that in front of me, but almost certainly it would be fiber.
Yeah, which means fiber basically to every house.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of exciting because you get that kind of volume of consumer-level devices because, of course, there's going to have to be a fiber modem, if you will, for the best translation of that.
Or at least fiber going to the outside. If copper going from the pole
Yeah, you could do fiber
to
the pole. You know, that's true.
Yeah,
but still, there would be so many fiber points, you would assume, that potentially that price could be reduced and we could start seeing more of that locally. can you see? I think I'm drooling. The 1 gigabit drool.
Yeah, and just to have a point of reference, because we're talking about the end of 2012, and we only just started 2011, currently, South Koreans get about 100 megabits per second and pay equivalent of $38 a month. Just
wow.
to, you know, throw that out there.
just to make us depressed? let's see, what... Let me talk to you a little bit about search optimization. So the general concept of we're going to have two part story today on search. You know, everyone knows that the way that you found online is through either somebody's physically giving you a URL or you go to Google. That's pretty much the ways things are found, right?
Mm-hmm.
You either already know the URL you're going to go to, or you're going to go to Google. And
sorry, I just had to like jump in there. Life before Google, a short story. It's a comic I'm put up on Geek.
Oh yeah, you're good.
I just thought of something I'd like to know more about. And the friend says, that's a damn shame. Life before Google. Or as Don actually said to me just before the show, no, that's when your father said, we've got an encyclopedia set right over there. You can go look it up.
Dad, this was printed in 64. I had a 19... No, I had a 19... Yeah, I think it was 1964 encyclopedia. So the knowledge prior to Google is all there. What happened to 78? All right.
What happened to N?
So, Google, of course, right now is kind of this predominant powerhouse, because if you can get good rankings on Google, if somebody searches for the term Miles Elam and they find somebody other than the person that's sitting across from me, that's who Miles Elam is, right? And that goes along with everything. If Google responds with, this is reality, then it is. And that's a very powerful thing. What I noticed, what I love, somehow Google's doing really good in a lot of stuff. When you search for it, the top entry is Wikipedia, which, of course, is that shared.
Very commonly, yeah.
Very commonly, it's that. And what's happened recently, I'm describing an article from last week that was New York Times. I'm posting up on GeekSpeak after the show. But the topic is the dirty little secrets of search. For a while, JCPenney has had an amazing search result on Google. And if you search for dresses or bedding or even area rugs, the top score has been JCPenney. And the way to do that is, the thing that's the issue, of course, is that if I want information about dresses, JCPenney, who does sell dresses, is probably not my best source. In fact, I kind of have this feeling like a company that provides a service based on the information you're trying to get is the wrong place to start.
It's a social conflict of interest.
It is.
The idea, they don't want to tell you about all dresses. They want to tell you about their dresses. Right.
That
very distinct difference.
And a lot of people, as a web developer and a geek, a public geek, a lot of people come to me and say, you know, my website's not getting good traffic and Google's not indexing. I'm on the seventh page.
This is an entire industry called search engine optimization,
that's
SEO.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, SEO is actually, that acronym has become very well known. And there's a lot of people trying to sell the wares of being able to increase your search engine results by optimizing your site. And Google actually has some documentation on what to do and also what not to do. Well, maybe they leave the what not to do kind of blank. But the issue at hand is, if Google thinks that you're trying to game their system, they will penalize you by decreasing your results. So what I always say is, if you want to get good Google indexing search results, provide really good content on the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is the level of value of a website. There's some kind of level of value. So if a million people are linking to me all about, well, let's say Alex, who's on the show sometimes, he's an expert on bearded dragons, which is a small lizard. And if because of all the sites that talk about bearded dragons, they link to Alex, now Alex's rankings are really high because people in the know about that topic are saying this is a source of value.
Well, he runs a forum site. So yeah, if you want to discuss it, if you want to ask a community about it, yeah, you would go to his site.
And that's a perfect example of something that should get high rankings. So how do you, if you're a local business, how do you become a high ranking? It's really tricky. And of course, locality Google interprets as well. So if you put your address on your site, Google will see that address and potentially will rank you higher based on the location you are.
They'll try to, yeah.
They'll try to. And all of this stuff is extremely complicated. But one thing you don't want to do is try to trick the system, because if you do that, Google will potentially punish you. And in this term, the black hat and white hat ideas are used a lot. White hat would be search optimization that's kind of in the rules of Google, and black hat would be something that would be not so good.
Right, so then SEO exists in the gray hat zone.
Yeah, well,
the entire industry works in the gray hat
zone. I would say you're totally right. But right off the bat, like if I go to a website, I can see like 15 things off the bat that would increase the rating, if you will. But it really has to do with document structure, some rules that Google suggests, putting a sitemap in place.
And also how often that site is updated.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big identifier.
Right.
That you
and we're not
fresh
talking
content.
About updating to kind of change things around. That's why when I talk to people about, you know, they're providing a legal service in Keene, New Hampshire, I'm going to suggest write a blog entry every week about the topic at hand. Whatever your clients are interested in, write that. Because then you become more prominent in the knowledge base of that service. And that's kind of the way to cheat, if you will, which of course is not cheating at all. It's just be more awesome, which is a good recommendation for anybody.
Right. And Google has been doing a lot of revamping lately. You were talking about fighting back with JCPenney, but they're also looking to stop the link farms.
Yeah.
The ones that are basically just taking that. I'm sure you've come across this before where you make a search in Google. It points to a site, you click on that site, and all that site has is a link to the article that you actually want. And then you go back to Google and you look, and the site that you actually wanted, the one that was linked to by that link farm, was number 5, whereas the link farm was number 1 or number 2.
Right.
And so that's one of the things they're working on, is trying to make sure that just it, having a site that just links to the place you want to go, just get rid of the middleman, go straight to the source.
All right, so we'll talk a little bit about more about search results and optimization in a little bit. I was hoping to get a guest on to cover this, but he's unfortunately too busy. So, Miles, you will go with your next story, sir.
I will talk a little bit about the possibility of IPv7. Now, we've talked about IPv4, which is the current internet. That's how when you have an IP address, that's
7?
IPv4. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
There was no IPv6, or okay, rather, there was none ratified.
Let's give a little bit of a baseline just to translate again. If you search for Geeks, if you enter in geekspeak.org, what actually happens is your computer looks up a service bureau called the DNS, domain name service, and finds where the actual number, the actual real address, which is an IP number of our service, geekspeak.org, and then your machine contacts that site.
Yeah, the internet phone number.
Right. So that lookup thing is called domain name searching. Without that, we would only be entering these numbers, which the ones that we use right now is called IP4, and it's four octets. Octets?
Yes.
Yeah. So four numbers, if you will, 1 to 3 digits long, separated by dots.
Four 8-bit numbers, yeah. Which is why they're called octets.
Yeah. But in any case, then we've run out of those numbers, and this has been covered a little bit on our show.
We
have no more space, if you will.
Rather, for the worldwide pool, we've run out of them, and now the regional pools are probably going to run out somewhere around late July.
Right. And this basically means that at some point you couldn't add more computers to the internet. That's effectively what it is. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But let's leave it at that kind of generality, because
directly connected to the internet. Yes.
Directly connected to the internet. Right. So there's a way of doing that and stuff, but we won't get into that. So one of the solutions to that was to basically increase the number, and that increased number is called IP version 6.
Right.
Right. What happened to IP version 5?
It was never
failed. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but IP version 6 has been around for quite a while. We've been talking about it, but it's just not.
It's been
going
a work
anywhere.
In progress for yeah. quite a while. And we've talked about it on the show, and that's a 128-bit number rather than a 32-bit number, which means that, you know, you could give a million IP addresses to just about every grain of sand on the planet, that type of thing.
It's a big number.
It's really ridiculously large.
What I like to say is that number is good enough for fully populating the solar system with as many sentient beings as possible, right. And sensors, and you still have more numbers left
right.
over.
So one of the guys behind the internet protocol, IPv4, mm-hmm. and the original internet, is a gentleman by the name of Vint Cerf. And he is actually an interesting speaker, and he's actually someone that when asked, he was saying, yeah, the internet, the IPv4 being 32 bits, yeah, that was my fault. That type of thing. It's really funny that way. And so people were...
You mean if IP version 4 just had been bigger, then we wouldn't have this problem?
Just to let you know what bit depth is like. So 32 bits is a little more than 4 billion. We'll leave it there. 33 bits is not just double. I mean, it's not just, a little bit more. It's actually twice as much. So 33 bits would be over 8 billion. And 34 bits would be over 16 billion. So, yeah, if they went to like 48-bit or something like that, we'd be safe for quite some time. NAT probably wouldn't have become as popular, and
yeah, sure.
We'd still probably have to do the migration, but
what is NAT? What does NAT stand for?
Network address translation.
And the basic idea is this: is if I have a computer and I'm facing the public world, and I have one of these public IP addresses, and Miles comes along and says, "Hey, I want to talk to Frank," and I go, "Oh, I know who Frank is," and I kind of handle the handshaking without Miles ever being able to do it directly to Frank, and that system is called NAT, and it's actually really clean. It's not as bad as like I can't really look at the data that well. But anyway, we'll go on. That's not the right solution.
Right. And so he's a very good person to ask when saying, what's the future of the internet and global networks and stuff like that? And so they say, okay, IPv6, we're trying to roll that out. We're running out of time. We gotta do that. So what are we going to do about IPv7? What's next on the horizon? According to Vint Cerf, nothing. There's not going to be an IPv7. There's no real point if IPv6 is so much. So the big problem is not the number of interconnects you can make, the number of addresses you can give out, the number of equivalent of phone numbers that you can give out. The limitation now is going to be latency when we go to interplanetary internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because the speed of light means that it's going to take a few minutes to get from the Earth to Mars. And back. The latency,
I think,
is
9 minutes, actually, depending on where Mars is.
But the latency in terms of like a return, like you send a message and you... So it's very much like that. We're going to go back to CB radio style, where it's like, hey, I need to get over to the, you know, into the transport pad. Over.
But that's not something we can solve with making a faster network or anything. I mean, that just that's
right. So what he's proposing is, and he was talking about this is his pet project, the extraterrestrial interplanetary internet. Is he's looking at a model that's very close to what we had with Usenet 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Usenet being internet news. It was people posting messages, and you replicate this repository of discussion information off to different points, and then people post those messages, and they sync up. And so if you know Usenet, you kind of have his idea for what the interplanetary internet would look like.
It's also similar, sounds like, to how mail works, in the sense that you're going to drop things places and then it gets duplicated. Oh, I see. Because that service has much more that idea of replicating the data structures and syncing them. Mm-hmm. So I've got a local copy of the news groups.
Yeah, maybe closer to a Unix to Unix copy, where so many things happening fast at a local level, and then you need to synchronize with Mars. You know,
right.
You're sending some stuff to Europa, so you bundle all your stuff together and then you compress it and you send it off.
And is he talking about that actually being part of the IP protocol?
No, he's talking about that you don't need a change in the IP, the base protocol for that.
Yeah.
What you need is just a different transport mechanism.
I love the idea that...
or rather, protocol mechanism.
Yeah. I mean, of course we're going to, in the next 200 years, if the species of humans keeps going and doing okay, we're of course going to have a different structure than IP. Like, of course it'll be different. Technology changes so fast, we have no idea what it's going to be like. But I like the idea of the people that are kind of designing the basic level routing communication stuff saying, yeah, we're done. This is the best way we can do it. you're listening to Geek Speak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. We are, of course, all the content we talk about is online at geekspeak.org. You can find our podcast there. Of course, we're on NPR as a podcast. We love listener feedback, but we aren't taking calls today. We are taking emails. So you're welcome to email us up. You can also participate on our IRC channel, where GeekSpeak, KUSP, all one word, on Freenet. And you're welcome to join us and chat away and ask us questions there. Ben's actually on the IRC channel this morning. We are, Miles and I are going to keep going on news. And Miles, I'm going to jump to you again, mostly because I've been paying attention to you instead of prepping for my story. I can talk more about search optimization of this wonderful article I wrote that is kind of the second stage. But why don't we let you do a geek bit? Do you have one? Something quick?
Ooh, a geek bit. Let's see if I can find something very quick. I did come across this wonderful clock. Now you're going, a clock? What's so geeky about that?
Does it tell time?
Yes, it does. It's very beautiful, too. But it's called the color clock. As the clock runs through, it goes through the color values of the color wheel.
Uh-huh.
So by looking at the clock and seeing the color, you know...
the general time.
Or at least you know what part of the minute it's on. And it starts... Yeah, it's... They have a screensaver for it, too.
Does the color change go through the color wheel per minute? So it represents your seconds? Or does it go through per day?
That's a curious thing. I'm not quite sure. I know that there are color changes per second. There are color changes per second, but I'm wondering if it's just changing the saturation value or something.
Right, you might do something else. I like the idea of doing that, but I'd be concerned about labeling a certain time of day a color, because we have a lot of emotional impact on color. There's a great chart about different regions of the planet representing, colors differently. Like black represents death to us, but in some countries it doesn't. It's that idea that it's a social norm. I don't want to label my time of day with that color, I don't think. That would kind of freak me out. Like, why would 3 o'clock be red? That doesn't make any sense,
Get it done. Get it done so I can go home. Get it done.
Yeah. Or stop. Don't do anything. Thank you.
As opposed to the color of red being, I guess that would be a wonderful time to get married in China.
That's right. Here it's more like rage. So I'll do a little geek bit
marriage
as well.
Marriage and rage. Kind of similar sometimes.
You're not even married.
can't comment on that.
Of course, I'm not either. We're not married. You want to go out? Nah. All right. So I'll mention the Verizon iPhone came out. And one of the things that's kind of cool about the Verizon iPhone is that it can act as a tether point. So you can turn the iPhone into a Wi-Fi access point. and thereby having local network access through your Verizon cell phone service. And the question is, how good a battery life is it? Because the iPhones, the battery life, of course, with a phone is pretty important. If you're going to use this as your Wi-Fi point, you're going to have a problem. Miles, you, of course, have a solution to this, right?
The iPhone 4 is pretty good with battery life,
but
I find.
You have to charge yours daily, right?
Sure, but then again, I'm on it constantly.
Yeah, I know, me too.
I have an instant messenger client on it that's on all the time. So, yeah, I'm draining it legitimately there.
Yeah.
So if I am constantly using it, like with a laptop, it still would expect it to last a good while,
yeah,
the portion of the day. And for that matter, if I'm using it to get my laptop on the net, I can always plug my phone into my laptop
and charge it up. No,
yeah.
Then sync turns on automatically and you lose the connection. But yeah, I know what you mean. So Eric Franken from CNET wrote this article. He just basically did a little test with his T-Mobile MyTouch G4, which is not an iPhone, of course. It's a MyTouch G4, which I believe, I don't know the phone very well, unfortunately. And then an Apple iPhone running it as a video player. So how long can you play video on these things? And the video on just the iPhone by itself, 10.3 hours. Not bad. I was impressed with that. And then as a hotspot, what he did is he used as a hotspot and then he used an iPad to connect to that hotspot and then watch the same movie. So it's the same data going through, if you will, but it's not actually a video player. For that, the hotspot battery life, it was 5.2 hours. So if...
That still sounds...
Yeah, it's not bad. So as a hotspot access point,
I would say that's so much lower than watching a movie. And at the same time, I'm going, I get 5 hours off of that?
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
What I thought was interesting is that if you took that movie and you put it on the phone, you're getting, 10.3 hours of continual play. I don't know if the phone could hold that much data, but he looped the movie. Versus through the Wi-Fi access point, because of course you're radiating, you've got to transmit and receive, and that all takes a lot of power. It's interesting to see that. Of course, he didn't talk about what the distance was to his cell tower. Right, and also the distance to the Wi-Fi access point, like all that's
right.
Going to matter.
The further
quite
you are
bit.
From the cell tower, the greater the transmission.
Right, I believe the phone, truncates its power usage based on what it needs to do. I'm not certain of that. It might be that it's just I'm alone. But moving on, yeah. I would say
that actually reminds me of something I've been talking with some friends about and wanted to share with regard to cell phones, cell towers, and the distances there. One of the things that we hear often is from people saying, I don't want a cell tower in my neighborhood. I don't want to have that extra, radiation.
The radiation or the visual?
Sometimes the visual, but there are a lot of them that they make the cell tower look like trees, or...
Sad trees.
Sad trees. But I also hear people say, I don't want a cell tower in my neighborhood. It'll be too close. And as it turns out, if you have cell towers further apart, it means that they have to transmit... stronger signals.
Interesting.
To get to your cell phone, has to send a stronger signal while you're talking.
Right, your cell phone that's away from a tower is going to do a lot more connections, a lot more of that handshaking to try to deal with it. And it's going to have data loss, so it's going to resend the data. So you're actually going to have a lot more transmission, assuming there's going to be cell phones in that area.
Right, but if you have more cell towers and you have a higher density of cell towers,
you can decrease them. Because they definitely tune set towers to try to not
interfere
with each
other. And the cell towers can end up being at a lower power, and the cell phones end up working at a lower power. So... it's really counterintuitive. I want lower cell phone emissions, so I want more towers.
What about this? What if we took and made only one part in a town have the cell phone, the access, and then ran wires from that place to our houses? Then there wouldn't be any transmission of RF. Wouldn't
that be
easy?
That's true.
Yeah. We had that network once. Do you have a home phone?
No, I don't.
I don't either. Cell phones all the way, baby. What's your next story, sir?
I was going to do a rapid fire of government news. And as usual, it's going to
be... As a political junkie, that makes sense.
That's going to be bad news.
Oh, no.
So there's a gentleman by the name of Dennis Montgomery, and the U.S. government paid him tens of millions of dollars because he had said he had claimed to create software that could decode Al-Qaeda messages. And these messages were embedded in Al Jazeera broadcasts. The CIA figured out in 2003 that... yeah, it's a fraud. Like,
really?
One, there are no messages there, and two, he doesn't have software to decode them. I mean, it doesn't work.
That's the way to make money, isn't it?
Right. The bad news it's great that they figured that out. The bad news is that other defense agencies still used it after that.
How long?
They're still doing it.
So wait, wait.
And to date,
which agency figured it out and stopped using it?
The CIA.
So the CIA goes, wait a second, this is completely ridiculous. This guy's lying. He's not doing anything. This is no data. We're not going
to
pay him
this
anymore.
This isn't like, oh, he tried it and it failed. This is,
but of course, he's not under their jurisdiction or anything. He's an individual that's probably outside the country. So they're not going to prosecute him or do anything to him. It's not their business. So they just leave him alone.
Or rather, the CIA is not involved with local law enforcement.
Right. So they don't do anything about it. Okay, he's American. So they don't do anything about it. And then years pass?
Yes. And and to date, no government agency has prosecuted
him.
Him.
What was he claiming he could do?
That he could decode secret Al-Qaeda messages that were embedded in Al Jazeera news broadcasts.
That just sounds ridiculous. Like, right off the bat, it seems stupid. Like, why would you use...
Well,
why would you
not necessarily. Because, for example, during World War II, there was the solitaire algorithm. You'd look at a particular page of the newspaper, and you'd have a deck of cards.
It's true that media's been used for data transmission.
Right, so if someone says, hey, I figured this out, that's worth a lot.
I get that.
That is worth...
I get that. But the reason why those things will work is that it's a highly targeted issue. Right, meaning you only have a few people that know the secret, right? And you're mm-hmm. able to communicate with them. So you take your spies, like in World War II, you take the people that are remote, and there's 50 of them that know the secret, and they all know that it's crucial that they don't share that secret. Okay, mm-hmm. that functions. So you have a small audience target. If you say everybody that, you know, if you share it around a lot, it will get out, and then the system is broken. So you have to keep it a secret. So if it's only for a small targeted audience, it's no reason to do it through that TV network, because if you want a small target information, there's so many better ways to communicate with them through encrypted, you know, net traffic.
But that's the thing, though. What happens if you have, for example, a pattern of pixels on the screen, and it's just short text message? The idea is, like, you have a pattern of pixels, and you put them through, in World War II terms again, an Enigma machine. And that gives you back out that short sentence.
I know.
That
but
is
why,
totally possible.
Why do it through TV? Why do it through that network? Why involve all those people? So I'm a person
because
that
they
wants
have the distribution network.
The way you get that is through satellite. So you've got network.
That's
that
true. If you have the internet,
it's completely useless when it comes down to, because why would I want to put more steps in the process? For example, on Al-Jazeera, they have scroller tags at the bottom of the pages, you know, that give you more news updates. All the news sites do this kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. There's actually more. And there's titling and stuff. All that system is a commercial system that adds to the video feed, kind of the last stage, right? So you're going to re-encode the video right when you do that. So the algorithm to actually have pixels encoded and all that would have to be really complicated.
This is also assuming, organization is colluding.
You'd also have to assume that those people were including, or at least the person in the last step is colluding.
Right.
Why involve
and
them?
And that everyone involved in that is keeping the secret.
Right. But now
it ranks up there with 9/11. It's like, yes, it was a conspiracy. Well, yeah, it was, because we had a group of people hijack planes.
And the thing is, if you had any kind of technology that used an image to try to make it more protective, and it was like more complicated than like a text message or something, or an encrypted email, if you were much more complicated, so it's kind of like a public forum and then public receivers, use a Flickr account. It's a lot easier. Or one of the 6,000 websites that allows you to upload images or video.
Right.
That would be a lot better than trying to go through some other organization that you've got to manage.
Yeah. It's talking about hiding in plain sight, but yeah. But at any rate, it's a fraud. Yeah.
Okay.
But at the same time, he's tens of millions of dollars wealthier.
By other organizations are still paying him?
I don't know if it's a service agreement or if it's a one-shot deal.
All right. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. Miles Elam's also here. And we're talking about the Geek News of the Week. The reason why I talked about the search engine optimization kind of gave you a base level stuff about how search engines work and Google's volume is because just this morning, Andrew Keen from TechCrunch wrote an article asking Google to stop cheating. So Google is very responsive when people cheat their algorithms to make their search results better. They punish them by decreasing their value on the site. So if I go in on GeekSpeak and try to put a whole bunch of tags and keywords in my headers and try to cheat the system so that Google ranks me higher, Google potentially could punish me for that activity. But the thing is, Google, the way Google actually does what they do is hidden. You don't know how they're doing it. So this article by Andrew Keen is basically saying, stop cheating, Google. Stop doing things in this weird way. Be transparent. And this is important, of course, because Google's 70% of the search market. They are a big player. But we don't exactly know how Google does the searching that they do, how their engine actually works, their optimization, the way that that system functions. We know from a very base level, Miles and I can describe to you that what we talked about earlier, you know, the more sites that link to you that have value increases your value on that topic that the link is happening. That's why you always want to make links kind of descriptive, or the paragraph the link shows up in is actually important. Like all that stuff we kind of know, because if we were to build a system, that's how we do it.
Well,
but above that,
that's the naive algorithm, because that's the one that was described by the Google founders back in 2002.
That's how they started. It was very effective.
I mean, 98, something like that.
It launched Google. That idea saying, if other people think this is important, we'll say it's important. That basic concept has been extremely effective at starting up Google. But now it's easy to game that system, because I can go and get 500 different websites, have them all linked to each other and to the place that I'm trying to target. That's the link farming thing. And how do you deal with that? Now, how do you know those things have value?
Right. And there's the question, though, is does Google have the responsibility as 70% of the market? Or do they not, in saying this is our trade secret, it doesn't matter how we do it, it just matters that we do it? In which case, as long as they're giving good results, you still go to them.
Well,
and if they don't, then you go someplace else.
If you think about it from a capitalistic point of view, Google's providing the service. You going there, you're actually paying them because they provide ads, and the ad revenue is there because you're there, right? So Google's a commercial enterprise making money off of good search results. That's their business. If they don't have a really good algorithm, if you go there and try to search for something, and instead of getting what you want, you get a site that's selling Viagra, and you were looking for, you know, knitting needles, you've got a problem, right? That's not you're not going to go back there anymore. And yes, Miles, I agree with you in a lot of sense. Google's going to do a good job just from a capitalistic perspective. Maybe we should hide what they do.
I don't necessarily mean hide what they do. It's a question of whether or not they should be compelled to do so.
But here's the thing. If you give that kind of thing to them, and then they go buy a business that has, and all of a sudden they get into a business that's competitive to some of their consumers. I mean, come down to it, a search engine actually automatically is competitive to its results, because if you go to Google and you look for web searching, Google, how is it going to respond? They'll probably respond with Google.
On the contrary, Google tried to make a Wikipedia competitor, Wikipedia still ends up higher in the rankings than that Wikipedia competitor always did.
The reason that probably is occurring is because Google's not doing collusion with itself, right? It starts up
It does, but if you put in a, for example, Chrome into a Google search, Google Chrome shows up number one.
But maybe Google Chrome is the most important thing with respect to Chrome from their algorithm. Meaning they might not have modified their algorithm to do that.
There's a paid Google ad at the top.
Well, of course, that one, that's fine. I mean, that's in their paid space.
But at the same time, how many people want a chrome finish on their car or on their bathroom?
Yeah, it's maybe not as popular anymore.
Implements, or I don't know. We'll see.
So one of the things that got my attention with this article was this. They've cornered the global market, and I'm quoting now. Let's see. If the company can invent a self-driving car, then it can certainly figure out how to make a ranking algorithm more transparent without becoming an easy target for content farms. So the idea here, the base level idea here, is Google's not being transparent. I've always assumed they're not being transparent on their system, because if they are transparent, it would lead to better ways of gaming their system. People would take advantage of how they do it.
Or duplicating their system.
I'm not so concerned about duplicating. I don't think that Google could actually be duplicated effectively and their market share loss because of that. I think that they've already got a strong point if they keep on doing a good job. I mean, they already have more PhDs than any other company, right? They've got a brain trust there. But this begs the question. This is what I want to talk to you, Miles, about.
Raises the question.
This raises this question. Okay, sorry. I always do that wrong.
Sorry. This is in honor of my philosophy logic teacher.
Right, yeah. What was it earlier? I asked you what it was what's the opposite of sublimation? When sublimation is if you've got ice and it turns directly into a gas, so a solid turning directly into gas without going through the intermediary liquid stage. So you can actually lose ice by sublimation. That's what freezers do, actually. The non-frosting freezers actually do this. And that process is called sublimation. But I wasn't sure what turning vapor, I should say, yeah, gas, not vapor, gas of water into ice was. And you said, I don't know if there is a term for that. And then you immediately...
No, I don't know if I know the term.
I don't know if I know the term for that. And then you said...
Deposition.
Deposition. So that, which it is. You claimed you didn't know what it was. And then you're back in the brain, the massive brain of Miles was able to spit the answer out anyway. So you didn't even know what you knew.
Well, I was just kind of going, okay, I know I studied that in meteorology. Is there a term for that? Oh, yeah, that was it. Deposition.
Now, of course, we didn't make sure that we're right on these two things. We might be wrong. But, you know what it is. It is deposition?
Pretty certain.
70%?
Yeah, sure.
Good enough for public radio. Okay, so do you think you can make it transparent how the process works? And still not allow for that to help somebody game the system.
That is impossible for me to answer without knowing what technique they're using.
Explain.
For me to say, yeah, they can do that without knowing roughly anything about their process and what's involved, it's like me saying, I can solve any math problem without actually looking at that math problem.
Mm-hmm.
If someone turns out that they're just working on something that's some basic algebra, like, yeah, sure, I can figure that out. Yeah, I can find some way that it would always work.
Well, okay, let's talk about something much simpler. Let's talk about keys. All of us rely on keys to open our homes. And not everyone necessarily knows how a key works. You and I really are pretty functional. We know about that. Mm-hmm. We're geeks, and therefore we like the idea of hacking, and so we know how things work. We backward engineer things kind of by default and thinking about it. But basically, the ridges and grooves in your key are places where pins inside the lock, little tiny pieces mm-hmm. of metal, will go up and down. And they fit on your key at a certain height. And each one of these pins actually is sliced and has a certain length. And behind that is more rod, if you will. So you can kind of imagine a pipe, two sections of a pipe, and they're different lengths. And one length, if you line it up correctly, the whole thing can turn because the break is exactly where the turning mechanism could work. If you put it in any other pattern, the cylinder won't actually turn because one of them will be in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a lock, the key grooves actually match perfectly what the pins in the lock match.
Unless you have a bump key and that's a whole other...
Yes, a bump key, right. Well, there's ways, because we know how that system works, it's easier for us to pick the lock. Because now we know that all we have to do is get all those pins to be in the right alignment and the lock will turn.
Yeah, or rather you make a bump key and then you're not picking the lock. And
what that is that each one of these little tiny pins has a spring behind it to push it down. And those springs, because you're using them all the time and you're always in two places, fully the key fully out or the key fully in, over time that spring has a bit of a memory. So meaning that spring is going to have more of a chance to fall in line with its upper position that's correctly.
And the key is made so that the grooves are not as deep. The key is made in such a way to optimize the ability to catch these.
Right. So items. What you can do when picking a lock, you can rake and bump these pins up and down. And the way you pick a lock is you put a wrench or a little tiny thing that can turn the key with a spring on it. And you put a little bit of tension on that. And then you can take another thing that's kind of called a rake, which is basically a piece of thin metal that has some bumps on it, and you kind of slide it back and forth while you're turning. And what happens is the pins kind of go up and down in kind of a random way, but there's a little bit of side pressure from the pin, and that kind of aspect of it can eventually allow you to open the lock. So that works, and we know how to do that because we know how the system actually functions. If you didn't know there were little pins in there, you wouldn't know necessarily how to pick it.
Or rather, what type of key are they using? Are they using a bank vault key, which is a very different
They get more complicated, that's right. And the tolerances, of course, depending on the tolerances of the lock, makes that kind of thing a lot harder to do. Now, if we instead made a lock that had a key, the key looked exactly the same, because that's public knowledge, right? But inside there was actually IR sensor, distance finding sensors, that knew the exact distances, it wouldn't work to rake it. It wouldn't mm-hmm. work to do that. So knowing the inside of the lock allows us to pick the lock. And the question arisen about transparency and what Google's doing, because Google has so much power in our society. Like a department store, an online store can fail if Google points their traffic away from them, right? It can cause serious data loss, a drop of sales.
Yeah.
And that power that Google has, is that something that needs to be regulated? That's the question. And if you do regulate, the transparency is actually a crucial part of it. And the question is, can Google do what they do and have a transparent system of doing it? And I don't have a lot of faith that they could. I think the secrets are important in that situation. I think as soon as you say the ranking is higher if you do ma 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 ma, if you do that in a cheaty way, then it's going to work.
Yeah, I guess I am falling on Google's side with this just because I think of just about any business. Let's say it's your core business, the core, the part of it that you, it's not an answer, it's not a human resources portion.
Right.
It's not the shipping and receiving, unless you're a shipping and receiving company. And someone says, I want you to show us exactly how you do this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know exactly what FedEx's processes are from the back end, how they get something from A to B.
Right.
There is that fine line between what is something that is safe to let out and what is actually a trade secret that
right.
is, this gives me a competitive advantage and keeps me in business.
The tricky thing about this is that because so much commerce is based off of it, that's why the desire to have it transparent is important. I mean, if you've got FedEx and UPS, and UPS has figured out that if they always make their drivers take right-hand turns instead of left-hand turns, they'll get increase in delivery times by 20%, thereby having less staff time. That's a major thing for them. In fact, we had an article about exactly about that. And FedEx doesn't implement that. UPS will be better as a company, and FedEx will have to catch up. That kind of thing's not my concern, in the sense that I'm paying them for delivery service and I want the best service at the cheapest price. It's their business to get better and better. But when lots of other businesses rely upon what they do, it becomes really crucial. It's not like these companies are paying Google to place them high. They're some unknown way that Google all of a sudden gives them a 10% or 10% increase or decrease in business. That's a lot of power to put into a corporation's hand. That's all. So I get the concern.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're towards the end of another day of Geek Speak. Miles, I'm surprised how little we covered in this.
Yeah.
I mean, we want to hit a couple of more of your headlines that you didn't cover.
Sure. The TSA, which I'd love to talk about, with the body scanners.
Yep.
Well, a TSA official, I mean, they get tested every once in a while. You have an inside TSA official go through and try to, you know, carry a gun on or carry some implement. Well, it turns out an undercover TSA agent was doing this, and they were actually able to get a handgun through the scanner at DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth.
So it doesn't even work?
And this is not, like, once. This is multiple times. And, yeah, no changes or disciplinary measures or anything like that has happened thus far. So we have a scanner, but the scanners are
not working.
Yeah.
Well, then they show you naked, but they don't actually work. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years, just like GeekSpeak. HASBtech.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. The Geeks Today, where Miles Elam and myself, Lyle Troxell,